and welcome to the Logic Consortium. Professor Nussbaum, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
Fine. It's good to be on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us. And you're, of course, the Ernst Freund Professor of Distinguished Service, a Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, that's right. That's the chair title, but I'm in the law school and the philosophy department.
And today I had the chance to go over many parts of your book, Political Emotions, Why Love Matters for Justice.
Wonderful.
And so that's going to be our topic for today. And so to kind of kick us off, so the big picture, why does love matter for justice?
Okay, so here's this problem, that in modern societies we have to ask people to do things that they don't always want to do. To have a just society, you have to ask people to pay their taxes, to treat other people decently, not being prejudiced against them on grounds of race or gender. And all these things require some degree of sacrifice of people's initial self-interest. So then what do? Well, of course, you can just compel them by force of law, but a society that has to keep compelling people and policing its central values is probably not going to be very stable. And so from the beginning of modern democratic societies, people have been worrying about how can we make people really care enough to support these sacrifices that they're making. And so this is not a problem if you have a monarchy, because the king just tells them what to do. But if it's a democracy, then if they don't really want to do it, they're going to vote out the people who ask them to do it. And so politicians all through the years, I mean, it's a theme, certainly Lincoln, it was a very big theme with Lincoln. It was a very, very big theme with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And many, many others. I talk in my book about India as well and about Gandhi. These are people who realize that you've got to get people to care about what they're doing with their hearts if it's going to really work. So that's my theme. Now, I think that in modern societies, we're very skeptical of that kind of thing because we associate emotions with fascism. And we think, oh, well, if people are going to be made to be very emotional in the political context, that means they're going to be goose-stepping and marching along and behaving very badly. But, of course, that's because the values around which the Nazis whipped up emotion were bad values. But if you have good values, you have to get people to care about those, too. And so my sub-theme is, how can we do this in a way that doesn't negate critical independence and the freedom of citizens to dissent in a liberal society?
And some things you look at is patriotism, the related idea. Yeah. And as you said, while you concede that patriotic sentiments can sometimes be used in not the greatest way, you talk about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr. as figures who have entered into our national psyche who we can talk about when we're talking about these issues.
Yeah, and they understood that if you're going to create a union, you've got to make use of symbols and emotions as part of what holds it all together. Now, Washington, for example, devoted great attention to the way he dressed, the way he presented himself in public, because he wanted to show that he was a man of the people. He was a president, to be sure, but he wasn't a king. And so when he was inaugurated, he wore a homespun suit. Lincoln was much more ambitious still. I look in detail at the Gettysburg Address, where he really constructs a whole story of the nation's history and its meaning, which is really, you know, it's a construction, because the value of human equality where slaves were concerned was certainly not the value around which the nation was founded. But it takes themes from the founding and then reconstructs them, gives them a new spin in a way that rallies people around the cause of whether a nation so dedicated can long endure. And, of course, now we go on and we recite that speech and children learn that speech and they learn to define the nation in that way. Of course, King, once again, I mean, he harks back at the very beginning of his I Have a Dream speech. He says 50 years ago, so referring directly back to the Gettysburg Address. And he writes another kind of ambitious, reconstructive story of the nation, in which the failure to make good on racial equality is a bad check that has come back marked insufficient funds. And then he moves the listener and the marchers to a new vision of the nation of the future and asks people to go forward into that future. Well, once again, it's part of what we now think is the nation, because every year we put down everything else and we listen to that speech, we celebrate that holiday. So I think the nation needs those emotional fulcrum points in order to really keep in our hearts those values of equality and justice.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to 88.7 WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola University. And we're speaking with Professor Martha C. Nussbaum about her book, Political Emotions, Why Love Matters for Justice. Professor, talking about this emotional fulcrum point and how we can make people care enough, you talk about one of the keys is finding effective political principles. And you have to find those in the areas of overlapping political consensus.
Yeah, well, there I'm really going into some details of political philosophy. John Rawls, whose views are not the same as mine, but I discuss his views a lot in the book, he believed that in a pluralistic society, you can't build the nation on principles that are belong to one religion rather than another, or to a secular view rather than a religious view. You have to find a core of principles that all the citizens, no matter what their religion or their secular view, can embrace. And he called that an overlapping consensus. So that means the principles have to be relatively narrow. They can't cover the whole terrain of human life, like our political principles shouldn't have any view one way or the other about the afterlife or the ultimate destiny of the soul. They also have to be thin, so you don't want to use terms like the soul, because then people who don't believe there is such a thing will not be able to embrace those principles. So the idea was to use an ethical language that we can all accept, no matter what else we attach it to. And actually, it was the same idea that the framers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights thought they had found in the language of human dignity and human rights. And they talked about it quite a lot, because they were from China, from Egypt, from France, and the U.S., and so on. And so they, too, you know, they saw very clearly that they needed a language that we could share, no matter whether our starting points were religious or secular, and no matter what cultural tradition we come from. So that's the idea that I am working with in the book.
And you mentioned, and you kind of brushed over this, that these principles should be narrow in scope and shallow as to their basis.
Yeah. I mean, what I mean, I did it very quickly just now, narrow in scope, meaning we don't talk about certain things, like what happens after you die. But shallow as to their basis, meaning we don't use certain very divisive notions, like the immortal soul. We try to avoid notions that would divide citizens, and some citizens would say, oh, there's no such thing, and others would think that it's the deepest part of what they believe. So the language of human dignity, for example, is that kind of thin ethical language. Some people will think, oh, what human dignity is something that resides in the soul or something that's given us by God. Other people don't think that. They think that human dignity is something purely of today and in human life. But we can agree in using the language of human dignity, and we can agree to a large extent on what we mean by that.
So in terms of areas of disagreement, in today's political environment, what are some of the main differences that are causing this chasm? Is it the idea of individual responsibility as one of those issues?
Well, I think, you know, really it's the same problem that the older thinkers I talk about in the book saw coming their way with the rise of industrial societies. Giuseppe Mazzini, the Italian patriot, said, you know, most people are occupied with their own self-interest. That's their main concern. So they want to make themselves succeed, they want their family to succeed, and they don't really pay much attention to the common good. And so, you know, I think that's the main problem today, too. And it's always a problem in any kind of society that's got a certain amount of freedom for people to pursue their own affairs. And, of course, they should pursue them, and they should care about them. But then the thing is, what is going to make them turn outside and care about something more than that, some kind of common good? Because if they don't really care about the common good, then we're going to get what we get today. A lot of people saying, well, government shouldn't support health care. Government shouldn't really do very much of anything because we can all survive as isolated atomic units like on the old frontier. So if we don't want that, and I certainly don't, then we have to make people care about one another, care about the values that hold us together, and be willing to support that with more than just lip service. I mean, of course, any society that's even going to defend itself and going to have an army needs people to care about the common good, and sometimes we forget that today because we have a volunteer army. But the truth is, if there were ever any real conflict, we would need much more than that. We would need people to be willing to die for their country, and so that's what the book is really about.
So how does one engage in a discussion like this, people who, when talking about the common good, say, we don't need health care for all of our citizens?
Well, I think you have to, first of all, get them to see very clearly what the fellow citizens are suffering because of the lack of that. And then you've got to portray it in a way that opens their eyes and their hearts. Roosevelt, during the Depression, understood that most Americans of means didn't really think about the poor, they didn't really know much about them, and they thought the poor bring their own trouble on themselves. I think a lot of people think that today. But anyhow, he saw that that was a real problem, that you weren't going to get New Deal legislation passed unless people had a new attitude to the poor, and given that there were all these out-of-work artists, he put them to work creating images, showing poor people as people with dignity who'd been hit by a terrible catastrophe. So he got these photographers like Dorothea Lange and others to really just think about what images would make people understand something that they didn't understand before. So that's the kind of thing that I look at in detail, and how the arts, architecture, public parks, all these things play a role in making us see one another. Now, in a different era, earlier in New York, they were going to build a park. So they had all this land, and they were going to build a park. Well, how would they do it? And Olmsted, who was very concerned about how the rich saw the poor or really didn't see them, he thought, well, the problem is that the rich go off to the Adirondacks, and they have plenty of fresh air, and they can get away from the city. The working people don't have any place to go. And so the result is they don't see each other, but also the poor people don't have any nice place to go. But if we make a park in an intelligent way, and this was Central Park, then if we're at all shrewd about it, we can not only give the poor people a place to go, but we can make it so interesting that the rich people will come there too, and then people will see one another. And so that happened. It's very successful. Right now, I think it's so hard to get near there if you aren't rich. I mean, so now there's a problem that's come up because now you have to be pretty rich to live near Central Park. So I think there's more work to be done. But then I also talk about Chicago's Millennium Park, which I think is a wonderful example of bringing people in and getting them to encounter one another. In this case, it's a kind of comic spirit where people see these funny screens of the Crown Fountain, and they see the distortions of their body and the curved surfaces of the Anish Kapoor sculpture. And so they have experiences of both sublime beauty and hilarious humor in the company of people of different races, different ages, different origins, and so on. So that's another example of how you make people have a new attitude to one another. And I think, you know, you don't see a direct line from that to being willing to support policies that do things for poor people in Chicago. But I think there's an indirect line, for sure. And, you know, compared to the old Grant Park, where the message that was sent was that, oh, this is pristine, it's elegant, only elite people need bother to go there, we won't soil it with people of lower class origin or different races. You know, Millennium Park is very different. It's a people's park in the way that Olmsted wanted Central Park to be. And I think creating that is really meaningful when you think about how people see one another. Now, of course, it doesn't right away make somebody go out and vote for healthcare, but it's just one piece of a much larger picture. You have to work on more than one front at once. And the hope is that once they see clearly the lives of people in other walks of life, then they're much more likely to care about what happens to them.
And speaking of a different attitude toward one another, one thing that you write is that proponents of the libertarian state typically assume and do not argue that their claims about human nature are true and apart from culture. Why is, talking about that, why is that an important point?
Well, my book is presupposing a certain set of political norms that I don't argue for in this particular book, because I've written four or five books before that, in which I do. And those norms are associated with the modern welfare state and not with a libertarian state. And I just wanted to point out in the passage that you're talking about that, of course, every kind of society could do the thing I'm talking about, that is, generate emotions to support its own cherished values. So if you're a libertarian, then you would think, well, now what symbol should I use? What emotion should I use? And I think, of course, American culture has got plenty of images of the solitary cowboy and so on that you could draw on to support your kind of state, because, of course, even a libertarian state still needs people to be willing to spend money to create legal institutions, a system of contract, a system of property rights, and so on. These things do not come for free. So even a libertarian state has this problem. And I just wanted to add that libertarians would, at this point, probably turn to me and say, oh, well, people are just selfish, so your job is impossible. Our job is not impossible, because maybe selfish people can at least cough up enough money to support the legal system and the system of contract. But people are not going to go beyond that. And the reason I made the remark that you were quoting is that I think, these claims about human nature need to be examined. And I use a lot of psychology in my book. I look particularly at the very wonderful research of Dan Batson at the University of Kansas, who spent many decades working on compassion, and how listening to the story of someone else's plight engenders helping behavior. So, there's a lot of good research now on compassion, on altruism, and there's also research, which I just talked about yesterday in the Chicago Humanities Festival. I was on a panel with the primatologist Franz De Waal, who studied both chimps and bonobos for many, many years, and he's shown that our evolutionary ancestors were altruistic. They weren't entirely selfish. And so that's another chapter in the book where I look at animal research and what it can tell us about our own personalities, what we come into the world with. So I think that, the more we know, the more we see, actually, libertarians are wrong. People are not completely selfish. But, of course, they have these tendencies that can be molded by culture one way or another. And that's where I come in and saying, what can a political culture do to mold them in the direction that I prefer rather than some other direction?
One thing I wanted to ask about was people have been commenting on an overlap between some Tea Partiers and then this Occupy Wall Street movement with respect to their disgust about corruption, influence of the fat cats, bailouts of bankers and big companies. Is this just an anomaly, or do you think that this might be an area of overlapping consensus, disgust with the influence of lobbying and corporatism?
Well, yeah. You mention a word that plays a large role in my book, and that is disgust. Now, disgust is a very easy emotion to arouse, but I think it's politically quite pernicious because it ends up harnessing the very powerful emotions of revulsion that we feel toward bodily waste products, slimy animals, insects, and so on, and directing that at people. So my own view is that it's always extremely dangerous to use the appeal to disgust in politics at all, even when the target is really some pretty bad people. Now, in fact, in Roosevelt's speeches, which I look at, he does that. That is, he does try to generate disgust toward the bankers. He calls them insects and so on. And, you know, I think that's probably one of his weakest points in those speeches. Because if we want to pursue the common good, we should not be doing that. We should be trying to see the good in people and try to get them on our side. Right now, the new book that I'm writing now is about anger and resentment. And I think what we see, what I'm just thinking about now, is that the greatest leaders knew how to see the good in their opponents and to address those opponents with respect and get those people on their side. Nelson Mandela is the one I'm thinking about most right now. And, you know, the amazing thing about Mandela is he had every reason to be so disgusted with the whole apartheid regime, but that was not the way he thought, and it was not the way he addressed people. He always tried to think, how can I get this person to do something good in the future? So it was future-directed, not past-directed, not resentment-based. And it started from basic human respect. And so, you know, if you know the movie Invictus, it tells you how instead of just, you know, vomiting at these rugby players who were no doubt racists, every one of them, except for the one black one, you know, he just decided, I'm going to get these guys on my side and through that do something really good for the country, bringing people together. And he did that. So I think that it would have been much better, frankly, if Roosevelt had approached the bankers the way Mandela approached the rugby team and tried to, you know, win them over, get them on his side. He might not succeed. You don't always succeed right away. But, you know, you put yourself in a good position and you show yourself in the light of a forward-looking, creative person. And so I guess I think whenever you have a movement that vilifies and demonizes, and of course I grew up at the time of the anti-Vietnam War movement, it was full of demonizing and vilification, I don't think it's at all helpful. I remember we used this term, the military-industrial complex, and that meant, you know, some bunch of animals who really are, you know, all subhuman, they don't care about real people and so on. And I remember years later when I first had to be on a presidential search committee in my university, not this one, but Brown University, and I went to meet the trustees. It flashed through my mind, now I'm going to meet the military-industrial complex. And then I had to laugh at myself because what I really found was people who were really trying to think hard about the future of Brown University. And so it would have been stupid to go think, oh, I'm going to see some disgusting animals over there. That would have doomed any common enterprise that we might have had. So I think, yeah, you're right that these two groups have a possible rallying point in an idea of disgust, but I think that would be the wrong way to come together.
So how do you go about challenging these, you know, take the military-industrial complex, for example, this idea that weapons makers and war machines have too much power in lobbying? How do you go about discussing that idea?
Well, you make these points in an argument. What I'm saying is you don't want to do it in a way that presupposes that the other side are irredeemable, that they're animalistic, that they're not fully human. And so you make a respectful argument. Look, I come from a university and in particular a law school where we have a very broad political spectrum and we try deliberately to have that at both the faculty and the student level. But we also have a culture of respect and civility, and we really do show respect for one another. So, for example, I was giving a paper one time in our Work in Progress workshop about same-sex marriage, which I support, and one of my most conservative colleagues asked me some very interesting, tough questions. which I was very glad to have because, you know, most of the time you don't get any challenge if you are for same-sex marriage. And then later he wrote an email saying, I just want to make sure that you felt that my questions were posed in a respectful spirit. And I said, yes, absolutely, I did, but I'm really glad you wrote. So that's our spirit, and I would do the same thing if I was challenging a more conservative colleague. I would try to make very sure that it wasn't like this is an evil person. Because obviously we want to do stuff together and we want to make progress together. And I think that would be good if politics were conducted in that spirit. It isn't always possible, but it sure would be good.
Speaking of ideas from the University of Chicago, this idea of regulatory capture and that, you know, that lobbyists really are so close with government agencies that they can kind of control the government agency's policy. Does that influence or inform at all our view of what the government and how the government can provide basic services such as healthcare and education and...
Oh, sure. I mean, we have to think about that. And that's one of the things that a lot of good work is being done, not by me, because public choice theory is a very technical area of law and economics, and I've actually audited my colleague Saul Levmore's course in public choice theory, but I learned enough there to know that that just really isn't a field in which I can make a creative contribution because it's heavily technical and mathematical and so on. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we have to keep on working on. And at a more informal level, we talk about regulatory capture a lot in the law school. So when you design institutions, you have to think about that problem and you think about how to avoid it. I have to say, I think in terms of the world, the U.S. is, doing reasonably well. That is, our problems of pressure and corruption are not what they are in many other countries. We can trust many of our public officials to behave well in their role. And in India, you know, to get anything done about corruption has required a mass movement, a grassroots mass movement, which still has not succeeded entirely, but it certainly made people much more conscious of the problem. I don't think the problem in the U.S. is anything at all at the level that it is in India. But in any case, you know, every country has some of these problems, and we need the best work in law and economics that we can get to deal with it.
In terms of whether something is against this, there's this idea that some people on the left tend to fetishize the role of government, meaning that we need a bureaucracy and to be running things and there to be certain checks on who we're electing. But there are those on the right saying, hey, we don't need the big bureaucracy. We can provide things like education through school vouchers. Is there a position of which is the best toward global justice, vouchers or non-vouchers, or is that not really it's more of an empirical question?
Look, I think there are conceptual questions and empirical questions, and they often get confused. So the conceptual question is, where does the buck stop? That is, if things are going badly, who is responsible? And I want to say the most core conception of the job of government is that it's responsible for the basic life chances of its people in a wide variety of areas. That doesn't mean, however, that government has to do everything through a bureaucracy. It could be a very lean government, and it could delegate a lot of its functions to private entities. And I think sometimes this works, and sometimes it doesn't work. We're finding this out because more and more of this delegation is going on. So, for example, the delegation of the parking meters in Chicago by Mayor Daley did not work terribly well, and now there's a lot of confusion about it, and we're locked into it, and it's been difficult for the current mayor to renegotiate that. And the delegation of the Skyway seems to have gone much better. It seems at least it's not a disaster, and people are using it, and it's in pretty good repair. So, you know, it's just a case-by-case question. Now, certain things that are so central to human dignity, I think you have to think very hard before you delegate. Prisons. The delegation of prisons to private entities has turned out to be quite a disaster in pretty much every place where it's been tried, because these private entities are not accountable, they're not transparent, and they've ended up using tactics that are unacceptable. Again, there's a lot of worry about delegating military functions, and I'm sure you know that these private subcontractors that the Army has called in have not always been as transparent and accountable as we want them to be. So these core functions that really implicate who we are as a nation and that involve a notion of human dignity, I think you really have to think very hard and have a lot of evidence before you would delegate that. Now, the schools question, I think, is a very, very complicated one, and the jury is still out. One reason the jury is still out is because when you say charter school and vouchers, there are many different things that are meant by that. Chicago's charter schools are supervised by the public school system. They have to meet certain criteria. They're really not just sort of cowboy entities out on the frontier. In some cities, they really are. So, you know, you're not really comparing the same thing when you compare charter schools in one place with charter schools in another place. And so I think by now we have a lot of different systems at work in the country, and we kind of look and see what the feedback is from charter schools and what does work and what doesn't work. And we can at the same time look at something else, that is, you mentioned voucher programs, and see whether creating more choice works or doesn't work. Now, unfortunately, when we look at the empirical evidence, it's still not fully clear. At least there's not an agreement among the experts. I happen to be personally convinced that charter schools, some of them are good and some are not good. And so you can't just say charter school. You have to say, what's the arrangement with the city? What's the nature of the accountability? And what criteria of inclusiveness are there? Because we don't want schools that are going to turn away people with disabilities or that are going to be racially one-sided and so on. So what controls are put on the charter school? And then we have to ask much more in-depth questions about the curriculum, about the instructors, what is their education, what is their certification. And so once we do that, we find out that there's a huge range in the country. And so what works is not charter schools per se, but it's a particular kind of school. Anyway, this is something that I think is very interesting, but it has nothing to do with my book.
Professor Nussbaum, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and all the best to you.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.